All right. Oh, we're going to go on to case number four, which is 10-13-49, United States versus Locke, and it's Mr. Flynn.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, I represent the appellant in this case, the criminal defendant in the at the trial court level, Mr. Michael Locke. Mr. Michael Locke was convicted of numerous counts of wire fraud.
This is the same Michael Locke who's been in the press in Milwaukee for the last year. Body snatchers and all that sort of stuff.
In today's paper, I'm sure there's a blurb about the trial he's involved, now the prostitution trial he's in.
Right, that's going on right now.
It's the exact same Michael Locke, that's correct.
He's got a lot of litigation he's been involved in.
A lot of criminal litigation. I think there was a reference to him being involved in a smorgasbord of criminal activity somewhere on this record. In fact, I'll say, one of the overarching facts I think we have to keep in mind as we look at this, at the time he was prosecuted and at the time he was sentenced, he was serving two consecutive life terms for murder and found himself at the time of sentencing in criminal history category 5 at a level 29 for the sentencing purposes. So he had a long and illustrious criminal record coming into this case. But I think those are important facts for this case. This is a mortgage fraud case.
Can we talk about the body snatchers later?
Well,
there's some media. The Journal ran with this. They run this periodically. I think it sells papers. The state court charges, not this mortgage fraud case. But I think it's precisely that why we're here on this white collar mortgage fraud case that we have to examine the issues that came up in the criminal case. He was serving two consecutive life terms for murder and found himself in criminal history category 5. And what the court did in terms of the 3B1.1 enhanced leadership organization role gave him 4 points for that. And we've objected to that, and we've gone through the record, and we've looked at must read, and we've looked at the 7 factors the court must take into account in finding enhanced leader, and none of it's there. This was a case of the facts were there was a Geronda McCray, a Keonti Clay, a Kevin Slayman, a Marcus Leonard, most forgers, thieves. Kevin Slayman was a businessman who actually knew the lending industry, who actually went to the closings, who actually communicated with the lenders, who actually got the money in at the closings.
But how does the fact of those professional con artists, as you referred to them lovingly, undermine the reliability of the lender files in terms of Rule 803?
Oh, yes. Yes. In terms of the authentication and the hearsay objections I raised at the beginning as to all these, normally 803 and 902.11 authentication objections are kind of yawners. They kind of, the doctor's office, the dentist's office, they come in, there's no issues. But if you look at 803, the hearsay statute, which 902, the authentication statute, relies upon, there's a very important phrase that says, if it otherwise has indicia of trustworthiness, that as you go through all the regular course, certified custodian, otherwise indicia of trustworthiness, these were forgerers and con men. There was no indicia of trustworthiness.
Is there any allegation here that the lenders were complicit at all in any of this activity?
No, there was no allegation as to that. There was the Koutramanos loan at the closing of the school teacher who, immediately after the closing, called up, I think it was Mr. Slayman, and said, hey, I'm really uncomfortable with this. I don't know what these documents all are about. I want out. Mr. Slayman called the lender in Long Beach and explained the dilemma, saying, this purchaser is saying she's never seen the documents or the property is very uncomfortable with this. The lender said, does the seller want to get out of it? If not, get it done. And that was it. So the lender from...
That may demonstrate that the lenders had incentives to close loans. But how does it show that the files themselves were compromised?
Well, because I think when we look at, and I don't think we can look at this case outside of the context of what was happening. Or we have to look at the context.
Why does that reflect on the lenders' honesty and integrity? I don't follow that. Yeah.
Because they had incentive to get these loans. The secondary market packaging was arising. It was becoming very fashionable. These lenders wanted these loans.
Does that cause them to falsify their books?
Yes, it does.
Why?
Because they want the loans because they know they're going to immediately sell those 2 months later, and those loans are going to be spirited down through various purchasers and end up somewhere in a derivative package and then being sold. And that's what happened. That's what happened with the collapse of the banks.
Well, you're going to falsify your records to accomplish that.
There could be emails. There could be any.
There could be a lot of things.
There could be a lot of emails.
No
any other.
I
guess that the theme of the argument I'm making here is to lay this sophisticated and what we've seen unfold before our eyes, this fraud on a massive scale on the backs of a pedestrian criminal act, seems to me to be overreaching. It seems to me...
Why should he receive less punishment for his fraudulent behavior just because someone up the chain didn't stop him from his illegal behavior?
He shouldn't. He should be punished, but he should not receive a 4-point enhancer for being a leader and organizer because it does not meet with the requirements of 3B1.1, nor does it meet with the requirements of must read. It doesn't show this was sophisticated. Remember the phone call he took from the jail where he's supposed to be the leader organizer saying, hey, you can't miss with appraisals. They're going to catch that. You can't do that. This is the leader and the organizer. This is the guy that... You could, if you look at this record, you could give this guy the application forms. You could give him the whole business in office. He wouldn't know what to do. Keontae Clay, Kevin Slayman, Jerron McRae, Marcus Leonard were there. And he was the fifth. He was the fifth. And if you look at this record, it is replete with references to how he was rarely at the office, that he did not recruit Simone Flynn. Recruitment is one of the factors in a 3B1 for giving leadership role. His boss, Keontae Clay's boss at KG Financial, schooled him on the loan documentation process. Keontae Clay started this idea before he even knew Michael Locke.
But the guidelines specifically recognize that a scheme can have more than one leader. And, you know, he's exercising decision-making authority. He's recruiting accomplices to, you know, execute the fraud. He's receiving more profits than all the other participants, with the exception of, Clay.
Well, in terms of receiving more profits, I think we proved at the trial on cross-examining the government's expert witness, that most of that money went into a joint account with Jerron McRae. It's attributed to him. It said it's his. But if you look at the record, if you look at docket 351, pages 128 through 1128 to 1130, it's very clear that the funds were deposited into a joint account with Jerron McRae at World Financial. So I don't know that we can just go say he got all the money. He clearly had access to it. He was a joint on it.
Right.
But Jerron McRae was there too. Then what about the quote, you know, when they're all special, no one's really special. When these guys could all do this on their own, why is he there? And particularly when we look at this, the trial court gave very short shrift to the leadership role. He, in a few paragraphs, said, well, he was the glue that held it all together. Well, the glue, it's kind of like that's what the equipment manager on a winning football team is called, or maybe even the mascot, not the head of the organization. He's the glue that held it together.
Well, it's the quarterback, too.
Perhaps. I mean, but not
I'm
really.
I'm talking about things I know nothing about.
But the glue, the kingpin, the top guy. Yeah, I mean, that. Where is the evidence of that? When you look at the record, Jerron McRae was the appraiser. He didn't know anything about appraisals. Kevin Slayman was the closer. He knew all about closing the deals. Keontae Clay started it going in. Where is the evidence in this record that he is the leader and organizer? A 4-point bump under 3B1.1.
All right, so look, it's the Marx Brothers, but he's, one of the leaders of the Marx Brothers.
One of the government's witnesses, Woodsley, says that Jerron McRae was the one that would structure the deal. She was a licensed broker. I mean, to just say it, it'd be nice to point to something in the record where it's conclusively established, other than to just say he was the glue that held it together.
Well, wouldn't you also acknowledge that his lengthy sentence is largely attributable to his repeated criminal endeavors, which put him in a criminal category of five from the outset? I mean, I don't know where the rest of these were, you know.
Yeah, my argument as to the length of the sentence is limited to the four-point enhancement under 3B1.1. I'm not disputing the criminal history category. I'm not saying that this sentence is within the guideline range, so it's presumptively reasonable. But I would argue under 3553, but I would argue that the other factors in 3553, precisely because he was serving two consecutive life terms for murder, and precisely
so
because
the length of this sentence make any difference then?
Well, it's 60 months of it concurrent, 100 months of it is beyond. But even if it makes no difference, I think the trial court kept referring to how much this doesn't
relevant, but it's interesting.
Doesn't make a difference, but the law is interesting, and the law is relevant, and the law should be complied with.
Are you saying it's beyond his life sentence?
No. Oh, he's got 100 months beyond the life sentence. That's correct. When he terminates his two consecutive life sentences, then the Federal Bureau of Prisons will ask him to come and serve 100 months. That's correct.
But life is life.
Life is life in with the state of Wisconsin right now. That's correct.
I wonder where he'll be serving that.
You know, when we look at 3553, at the very beginning, it says to take into account the nature and circumstances of the offense when deciding what the sentence should be. And I submit that the court erred here as well, too, in not taking sufficiently addressing that and not sufficiently addressing the broad-scale fraud that was occurring around the country and in Milwaukee. I see my light is on here. Does that mean I'm into my rebuttal time now? Yeah, I'd like to reserve my remarks.
And I want to hear you again. So.
Oh, thank
great.
You. Thanks.
Okay. Okay. Ms. Kraft, hello.
Hello, Judge Rovner. Judge Cudahy, Judge Evans. Good morning. Good morning, counsel. My name is Carol Kraft. I'm an assistant United States attorney from the Eastern District of Wisconsin. I represent the government in this appeal this morning. I also represented the government at all the proceedings in this case below. It's the position of the government of the United States that there is no merit in any of the four issues that the defendant has raised in his appeal.
Well, wait a minute. The lender files. Let's talk about the lender files because they included the fraudulent documents.
They did.
That were created, you know, by this group.
By the
and
defendant.
That fact alone would indicate a lack of trustworthiness under 803, wouldn't it?
Well, I would disagree with that, Your Honor. The lender files were subpoenaed by grand jury subpoena. They were properly certified. They were pursuant to the rule made available to counsel along with the certifications prior to the time that this case came up for trial. He had an opportunity to review them to determine on what grounds he was going to object. He objected in the joint final pretrial report and at the joint final pretrial. His basis for objecting was that the lenders must have been complicit in this somehow, so we couldn't trust these records. Judge Stadmiller said, unless you can give some reason to believe, you know, other than something just general, something speculative, they're going to be admitted. And they're going to be admitted because the rule has been set up for a reason, to avoid the waste of time, the waste of resources. Mr. Flynn's objection was that we should bring in the custodian of records for
what
these.
What was the purpose of the record, of introducing the records?
The purpose of introducing the records, and what we did, Your Honor, was we moved them in as certified documents in bulk, where each lender record was about the size of an accordion file. And the judge received them subject to relevance. We extracted from them certain documents that were relevant to the charges against Mr. Locke and his companions. Mr. Locke was the only one who stood trial. But those things were the 1003, which is the loan application, which were falsified by Mr. Locke and his companions. The reason that those were relevant was to show that, in fact, they had submitted false information about these straw buyers to the lenders in order to obtain these loan funds. We extracted the appraisals that were submitted in connection with all of these.
Well, you introduced them to show they were false, basically.
Right. Well, actually, so it would be an exception to the hearsay rule because we weren't introducing them for the truth of the matters that were asserted. But we felt that they needed to be certified records in order to have the proper foundation in the first instance. There was never any evidence at any point in this trial that any of the lenders were complicit in this. And the evidence that was presented showed that the defendant and his cohorts went to very great lengths to mislead the lenders into believing that these straw buyers were creditworthy, that they had income and assets that would enable them to pay these mortgages, when in fact none of them were ever going to pay the mortgages, that the properties were worth what the appraisal said they were, when in fact they were distressed properties that were in very poor condition and were not worth nearly what the appraisal said they were. We also extracted documents that showed verifications of deposits, of employment, of rent, that were totally fabricated at Mr. Locke's direction by one of the other defendants in this case, Marcus Leonard. And so our purpose in having them presented to the jury in the first instance was to show that Mr. Locke engaged in this fraud, along with those others that he was directing in this scheme. I believe that this is exactly the kind, these lender records are exactly the kind of records that are intended to be introduced by certification. They're particularly under circumstances where there's no indication at all that the lenders were complicit in this fraud. And so I think that there's no merit in the first issue that the defendant has raised. The court properly exercised its discretion. There was no legitimate objection that was raised by the defendant. The court properly received those relevant documents from the certified files, and there was no abuse of discretion in this case.
Why receive an upward adjustment for his role in the offense?
Because the evidence was very clear that he was a leader organizer of this fraud scheme. Keontae Clay, who was his partner, testified that they devised the scheme together. It initiated when Mr. Locke told Mr. Clay that he had obtained Stacy Happel, who was the first straw buyer, as a straw purchaser for, it was five properties. Mr. Locke directed Mr. Clay to find some other type of employment for her. He said, we need to have some kind of an employment to show on the loan applications because she's a waitress. She's not making the kind of money that's going to generate creditworthiness in a loan file. So he directed Clay to find some other employment. Clay approached Nicole Brown, who was another defendant in this, to in fact verify falsely that Ms. Happel worked at Jasmine's Learning Center. Mr. Locke and Mr. Clay continued to repeatedly use Jasmine's Learning Center as a source of employment for the multiple straw buyers that were part of the scheme.
But now, the answer is yes, he received an upward adjustment?
Yes, he did, for role, yes. And he received it because he deserved it. And the record is replete. The evidence over and over and over showed that he was a director and leader. He organized the scheme in the first place. It was an extensive scheme. There were at least 8 straw buyers. There were at least 24.
Mr. Clay.
Oh, Mr. Clay hasn't been sentenced yet. He is, he's going to be sentenced on September 29th, and the probation department has recommended that he also receive a role enhancement. But Judge Stadmiller noted at the time of Mr. Locke's sentencing that Mr. Clay was really almost equally involved as a leader organizer of this, but that as the statute and the guideline and the case law says, there can be more than one leader and organizer. There were many other people who were at a lower level than Mr. Locke. This wasn't Ocean's 11 where everybody came together and they had similar skills and they each took a part in this. Mr. Locke and Mr. Clay organized this scheme and they drew in all of the other people. And Mr. Locke, one of the most compelling things at this trial was the recorded conversations between Geronda McCray and Michael Locke in the jail, because at one point in time he was revoked for one of his other or he was in custody for one of his other offenses. And the jail, of course, has recordings, and inmates know that they're going to be recorded, and I don't know why they talk, but they do. And Mr. Locke is telling Ms. McCray how money from the latest transaction is to be distributed. And she's saying, Keontae wants this much. And he's saying, well, you tell him Michael's going to be out in a few days, and then we'll figure out, but you give him this much for now. I mean, those conversations are replete with direction. Now, I think it's important that Judge Stadmiller heard all of the evidence at this trial. This isn't a case where somebody pled guilty and we each submitted the government version and had to argue why the role enhancement should apply. At the sentencing, Judge Stadmiller said, I reviewed my notes. I've reviewed the evidence. Mr. Locke is clearly a leader organizer. It may be that Mr. Clay is almost equally involved, but they were both the prime movers. They were both, he got the lion's share of the proceeds, and they were both responsible for organizing and leading this. He was right. He was right, and that there's no doubt that he, there was no clear error on this record. His decision about this should be affirmed. The other two issues, the redacted summary of the indictment, which counsel hasn't addressed yet, I think it was proper. It lays out the scheme. It wasn't prejudicial. And when Judge Stadmiller read it, he read the cautionary instruction telling the jury that this is just a formal method of charging. It doesn't create any inference of guilt, and you're not to take it as including an inference of guilt. And then finally, whether or not Mr. Locke should have received a guideline sentence, a presumptively reasonable guideline sentence, as he did. This is a separate offense from the murder convictions that occurred in state court. And yes, he's serving a life sentence for those. But it doesn't mean that he shouldn't be separately sentenced for this serious conduct. Who knows? Maybe his state court sentences will be reversed for some reason. Then he'll be serving the 13-year sentence that Judge Stadmiller gave him. Maybe he'll never serve this sentence because he'll never get beyond the two life sentences. But this was separate, serious criminal conduct. And there's no reason on God's green earth that Judge Stadmiller should have said, oh, well, you're serving these other sentences, so you, in fact, shouldn't be sentenced to any serious time on this. The sentence was totally appropriate. Judge Stadmiller considered the 3553 factors, and the sentence should be affirmed. There's just, it was reasonable under all the circumstances, and there's just no reason to overturn it. Unless the court has questions, I think I really have completed my argument. I would ask the court to affirm Mr. Locke's convictions and sentences. There's no merit whatsoever to the issues that have been raised in this appeal, and I would thank the court for its time.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Okay, Mr. Flynn, how much time? 4 minutes.
I want to address the surplusage argument that we objected at the time in the jury instructions where the trial court included what I argue is the government's theory of the case. 24 paragraphs were read to the jury in the context of...
How did Locke's proposed jury instructions contemplate explaining the charges against him?
With the last page, if you look at the government appendix 13, the jury instruction at page 13, take out paragraphs 3 through 8, and the conduct, the factual support, is supported by the last page. With the bullet points. Count 2, charges Locke with causing a wire transfer of funds in the sum of $166,720 from Brea, California to Milwaukee on or about January 19th. That comports with the law. That comports with Rule 7 of a short, concise statement. But to go in, the large question here is, if you disclaim at the beginning, this is an indictment, it's not to be used as any inference of guilt, then why read it? Why go into all that when there is a sufficient facts at the end? This reads like a theory and is easily confusable. We objected to it. The Marshall case that the government cites in support of its argument on this point, it does not apply here. There, the defense failed to object to the reading of the jury instruction and the indictment and the submission of it to the jury. We did object to the reading of it and the submission to the jury. Now, I want to address the 3B1.1 argument here, and I think the must-read case is very, very important here. Must-read at page 1103 says the core focus is relative responsibility when deciding a four-point bump under 3.1.1. The core focus is relative responsibility. Those who play an aggravating role in the offense are to receive sentences that reflect their greater contributions. That has to be read in conjunction with the seven factors that the guidelines ask us to consider, the nature and participation, the exercise of decision-making authority. It would be comfortable to know that the person being charged as being the leader knew the details of the thing he's supposed to be leading, that he knew what an appraisal was, that he knew how to deal with lenders, that he knew he could close on something. If we go through all these with the core focus of relative responsibility on this offense, at best, the government cites his leadership role as that of muscle, and the muscle man usually is not the leader. If we look at those seven factors, when we go through here, witness after witness saying he wasn't there at the office, Geronda McCray made decisions, she structured the deals, Slayman did the closings, Keontae Clay had this organization, had this idea going before he was even released from prison, you get kind of a qualm, as one of the courts said, about the leadership role here. And lastly, Your Honor, I think, and this was an overarching theme, I think I tried to express throughout this, and the Cutramanos, never forget the Cutramanos lender, get it done. Slayman calls up, the seller, the buyer feels queasy, she hasn't really seen the property, doesn't really know much about the arguments, and this victim lender says, the seller object, get it done, and gets it done. We can't just close our eyes to that. We have to recognize something much larger than Michael Locke, perhaps muscling some mortgages, was going on here. And I think when you look at 18 U.S.C. section 3553, where it says, in deciding a sentence under the statutory requirement, take into account the nature and circumstances of the offense, I think that submits you've got to look at how these loans were being spirited out, how these lenders wanted these loans. And when you look at the relative culpability, as Musreed says, I don't think you're supposed to lay it all on the shoulders of Michael Locke. If the court has no more questions, I've concluded my remarks.
There's one of the buyers here, a bartender named Simone Flynn. I assume that you're not related to her.
Bartender in Miami, Florida. Not related at all. No.
I didn't think so. Right. But I thought, I can ask that because I've known Miss White and Mr. Flynn for a long time.
Right.
It's very Ms. fine Kraft. Milwaukee. Ms. Kraft, Carol Kraft, as very fine Milwaukee lawyers.
Well, I can second that. What a great job you both did for your clients. And you were court appointed. So you really have the deep thanks of
Thank you very much.
Our court for the kind of job you did for Mr. Locke.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you as well very much. Have a good trip back. Okay.
As long as they don't think you're Betty White.
Oh.